this is where Texas politics gets interesting. Here again are two guys named Jason, some great guests, and cold Texas beer for another smart conversation on Y'allitics, the unofficial political podcast of Texas.
Hey guys, welcome back to Y'allitics. We have a great episode today because it's something that Wheeler and I have both talked about. It's actually the only city in the state of Texas Wheeler hasn't lived, I don't think.
I have lived in Austin
for years. Of course you have.
Thanks for knowing me.
Have you really?
Yes,
you really?
I have.
The only
major city in Texas that I still have not lived in is Fort Worth. I've done Dallas, Houston, Austin, San Antonio, and El Paso.
I'll talk to the managers here. We'll get you over there. That's no problem at all.
Get me out of
here.
To
do. Easy to do. Yeah, we'll make that happen. But that's good Wheeler trivia to know. Didn't realize that.
We have an author on today, and he brought a beer. Whiteley did not bring a beer to this podcast.
I have one.
I did, and our author did. And I'm shocked at you, Whiteley, because you always have a desk full of beer. So I know you ran over here to grab one. Is it a Texas beer, though?
It's always a what kind of question is that?
I don't keep anything in my desk. One.
Yeah, but I don't keep anything at my desk. It's not a Texas beer.
Okay. Good
this is a, well, you know, before we get into our beer, let's introduce our guest because he has a beer as well. Alex Hannaford, he is an author. He's a former Austin resident, and he has a great book out now. It just came out last week. It's called Lost in Austin. It's available to buy, and we're going to get all into this because it talks about the cycles. Maybe. I don't know if that's a good word, Alex. You'll help me out with that in a minute. But the cycle that Austin is going through where it's crazy unaffordable now, and a lot of people think it's lost some of its luster. But we'll get into that in a second. You brought a beer, man. What'd you bring?
I brought a Southern Tier Juice Jolt, which is in honor of my new the state that I now call home, which is New York State. I'm upstate, and this is even further upstate.
People probably realize that your Austin accent doesn't sound like that. I should have said it earlier. You're originally from London. You've lived in Nigeria. You lived in Hong Kong, and you spent more, I think, a decade or so in Austin. So that's where you get your license to talk about the city.
Yeah, actually, I was in Austin for about 17 years, but I can't tell you the amount of times that I would meet people in Texas and I would hear, you must be from far East Texas.
Oh, really? They thought that was an East Texas accent?
Yeah. No,
not even close.
They were joking, like, but yeah.
Keep going
I never
east.
Lost the accent.
Keep going
I was
east.
There a long time and never lost it.
Yeah, keep That's going funny. East. Wheeler, what are you drinking, man?
I had hoped that I would have had an Austin beer in my desk. I have one left, and it's Moorefield Blonde Ale. This is out of Mission, Texas, down in the valley. I was hoping it would be an Austin one by chance, but it wasn't. How about you?
Disappointed in you. Yes, I have a Dallas beer, actually. Oh. It's the Lee Hazy Oswald.
Ah, yes. The old favorite
from Oak Cliff Brewing Company. Yes.
And great you're going to be drinking yours warm, just like I am.
Yeah, why not?
Hey, isn't that kind of English style, though, Alex?
It is, yeah. I was going to say, I've just come back from England, and I was in the pub with my dad having a pint of what do you call it? I think it's called ESB is the technical name. Which is kind of like, yeah, warm, flat, bitter.
Okay, that's kind of how this is going
Delicious.
Down today as well. So yeah, great. Cheers, everybody.
Hey, yeah, cheers, absolutely. Thanks for joining us, man. Next time you're in town, you could show us some places to go, especially if we do this podcast in Austin. I'd love to have you down there.
Although a lot of those places have closed, and your book kind of gets into that. You know, so many of these iconic Austin landmarks, you know, including where Janis Joplin got her start, have gone away in the name of quote unquote progress, I guess, Alex.
Yeah, I mean, the book, you know, I'll kind of say that it's I think it's important to say that I'll always love Austin. I mean, Austin gave me so much. I mean, I moved there I found Austin sort of for myself in 1999, moved there in 2003, met my now wife there, who's a Texan, went to UT. Our daughter was born there. So, you know, I mean, I owe Austin for everything, really. But I think that it's important to be kind of critical about things. Otherwise, they don't change. And when I left Austin, I certainly didn't sort of, you know, leave thinking, oh, I'm going to write a book about why I left. But a year or so after I left, you know, I was having conversations about why I left. And sort of my agent decided and I decided that this could make a good and interesting book to kind of examine, like you said, all the things that have changed in Austin over the last, well, I took 20 years as my timeline because that was my own timeline, you know, from 1999 when I discovered it for myself to 2019 when we had kind of all but packed up our bags to leave. So that was my kind of timeline, but then I wanted to each chapter is a different theme. So there's one on gentrification, there's one on climate change, there's one on, you know, guns and things like that. And so I dive back into history a bit further in each chapter as well. But yeah, I talk about all the things that have closed and changed and what that means. And I guess sort of to extrapolate from that a bit about what that means for American cities more broadly.
Well, let's talk about this. I want to take you back to 1999. You were 24 years old. You were with a buddy, a mate from England, I believe, and you were traveling cross country. And someone told you, "Hey, you need to make sure you go to Austin." And you guys were like, "What are you talking about?" So you, I think, hopped in with the Firebird, the Pontiac Firebird. You write in the book, and you took off towards Austin as well on your road trip. You described it then as a kitsch retro America light, where you could forget the real outside world. And you went on to say a little later in the book, it was a weird, intoxicating mix of frontier town, hippie holdout, and indie Mecca with too many Mexican restaurants to count. But I think the theme of your book really kind of is saying that the Austin of that era has long since faded. Is that right?
Kind of, yes and no. I mean, look, I think that the sort of the point of the book was that, you know, I noticed what I noticed. You know, I noticed venues that I would go to closing. And I was talking to people about, obviously, I lived there through the changes. So, I mean, it was very kind of visceral what was going on to me. But I think when it, what there was a kind of a disconnect between that and what I was sort of feeling and what I was seeing, to where it was very kind of interesting actually going back to Austin as a journalist and suddenly sort of saying, okay, I'm kind of going to try and report on this dispassionately, even though I've lived here for nearly 20 years. And talk to people about those changes and what you know, really dig into kind of the statistics and actually was, you know, it feels like everything's changed, but what has actually changed? And you know, I mean, it's I'm a journalist, so I have to kind of go with the facts, and you can't really argue with those facts. So I always thought when I wrote the book that there are going to be people that disagree with me, that may say Austin's the best place on earth. I've just moved there last year and I think it's fantastic. And I've got no argument with that. I mean, you know, I really do believe that, you know, people can go there and think this is fantastic. What the hell are you talking about? And so there's some element of admission that, you know, maybe it's sort of rose-tinted spectacles kind of looking back over this, you know, there's a famous saying, you know, Austin was the best. The first day that I got there. And I think everybody says that. But I think there were things that I dug up in my research that you just can't argue with, you know, and that's sort of, you know, the statistics on the climate changing and things that were happening, the venues that were closing and districts that were changing, the fact that for a long time, Austin was the only fast-growing city in America with a declining black population. You know, there were very real, profound differences and things happening because of gentrification and because of, you know, this what I describe as this sort of tech boom that kind of came to town. And I think, like you said at the top of the podcast, that this wasn't the first time it had happened. There are always booms and busts, yeah, but a tech boom had happened before in Austin. So we actually, you know, I dug into this research which showed the predictions that were made back in the 80s as a result of that tech boom. And it was just insane reading this, you know, it was actually by a professor at the University of Texas who was predicting these things that could happen as a result of this massive influx of tech to the city. And it was all negative. I mean, it was things like you're going to, you know, the music scene is going to be damaged, venues won't stay open, there's not going to be enough like drinking water for everybody, you know, if it keeps growing on the trajectory it does. And then there was a big crash, the economic crash, that sort of saved the day, because then what happened was, with all these venues that were closing back in the 80s, there was a sort of reprieve. And so the economy crashed and everything, rents went down. And so people were able to start new venues and stuff. So then you had the kind of, you know, I'm really simplifying, but you had the sort of 90s kind of punk scene in Austin and stuff as a result of those venues being able to open or stay open. And then it kind of happened again, right? This is the tech boom that we're talking about now. And my argument in the book is that there was sort of no going back this time.
And why is that? Why is it different this time around? Because, you know, as you mentioned, we've seen these cycles before. We've seen, you know, big parts of the culture there come and go. We've seen gentrification for a long time in Austin. What's different about this time where it's more permanent, you think?
That's a good question, and I think, again, I'm sure people might disagree with me, and I think that it, you know, to preface this by saying that the big sort of elephant in the room here is affordability, and that kind of really comes into everything I talk about. You know, we can talk about Keep Austin Weird, but I think all that comes down to affordability as well, which we can kind of go into. But I think in a nutshell, you know, there are a number of things that changed and that there's no going back from, and affordability being one of them. When you have sort of, you know, black and brown people being displaced from entire areas in Austin because the rents and the property taxes and the prices are going up and they leave town, you know, what are you going to do? Say, please come. I mean, actually, the funny thing is there's a piece in the book where I do describe this right to return policy that was kind of talked about, and there was areas in Austin where they were building properties and giving people who had fled Austin because of the affordability problem the right to return and kind of encourage them to come back and buy at affordable rates. So affordable housing is a big issue, which we could go into, but that's the key thing. And then, you know, what else had changed? You know, people online have been arguing with me about this, but you know, the fact is that the skyline is completely different. Now, you may say, well, who cares? And that's fair enough, but I'll give you just one anecdote if you'll allow me. So there's two things that happened when I was in doing the reporting for my book. One of them, I was having lunch with a friend of mine, British guy actually, who's a writer, lives in Austin. He made a name for himself. He coined the term Internet of Things. So that was his
Oh, wow.
baby. And he writes sort of popular science books and stuff about creativity and things like that. We'd had a conversation about sort of future cities and stuff and you know, what could happen. And when I left him that day, I went to stay with a friend of mine in Austin. I was st staying with a friend, and he texted me a picture on my cell phone. It was a picture of a skyline, a city skyline. And this was sort of the tail end of COVID. So things were kind of opening up, and you know, people were kind of sort of just about kind of coming out of the pandemic and lockdown and stuff. And he texted me a picture of a city, and he said, if I told you this was Austin, what would you say? And I'd say, yeah, it's shocking, isn't it? And he said, it's not, it's Wuhan in China.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, I would never have known. It was just a city of steel and glass, and it looked, you know, kind of like Austin. There's no way I would have known any different. You couldn't see the sort of iconic Austin buildings anyway from certain parts of the city. You couldn't, you know, you can't see the Frostbank Tower if you stand in a certain part. You certainly can't see the Capitol from all around the city anymore, or the UT Tower. These are dwarfed. And so that's the first kind of anecdote, which I found shocking. But then the other one, I was walking around the city for the book with the architectural historian for the state of Texas, a guy called Charles Pevateau. And at one point, we stopped on the corner of Guadalupe, and we just kind of looked at the skyline. And he said, look, I'm not against building and I'm not against change. He said, but you have to ask yourself, look at this steel and glass, and ask yourself in 50 years' time, which of these buildings will we want to put a preservation order on? And the truth is, very few of them, because they're cookie cutter. It looks like any other city. And if you're okay with that, if you say, I've moved to Austin, I like the restaurant scene, you know, the sanitized streets, the private members clubs, the high-end stores, and these beautiful steel and glass buildings, fine. It's just not the city that I moved to in 2003.
You mentioned the skyline there, and there's a line in the book which I'm never going to look at the Frostbank Tower the same again. It's the building with, you know, it's the one that kind of goes up at the top, and it has like
Yeah.
four prongs that come out of it.
And like
And
feathers at the top. It looks like
well,
feathers.
yeah, but the description in the book, I can't think who it was described this. Was it your wife or somebody else? They said, oh, that's a nose hair
It was
clipper building.
Marcia Ball, who's a famous singer and pianist,
Yes.
and she lives in Austin. I was interviewing Marcia and her husband for the book, and she described it as the nose hair clippers.
They look like a
Totally,
giant
it
pair
looks
of nose
like
hair clippers. Yeah. And maybe Frost Bank will never advertise here on Yolitix, but that's how I'm going to look at that building from now on. You know, you write in the book. Hey, well, let me throw out a couple things here. Austin has had several tech cycles. I think in the 70s or 80s, there was a UT students, two brothers who created some games. They made millions off of. They sold those.
The Garriott brothers.
Yeah, the Garriott brothers, Michael Dell, and then what we see happening right now with X and Tesla and things like that. You said, you know, everything was predictable because we've seen this happen in other cities. My question is, why didn't Austin see this coming and try to rein this in to manage it?
Well, actually, I mean, you know, when I talk about, we should have learned from the past, I mean, I actually wasn't talking about other cities. I was actually talking about Austin and going back to this study that this UT professor, his name is Dowell Myers, and he did this study in the early 80s. So it was there. I mean, it's literally there in a published paper that warns of all these impacts, huge, profound impacts that would happen to Austin if this untrammeled growth was allowed to continue. And like I said, there was a economic crash that was big enough that it sort of put the brakes on. And obviously it didn't
but
stop
that was
happening.
Alex, that was 1987 when he wrote that. And he said that the development success at the time in 87 will kill the quality of life. Will kill the quality of life goose that lays the golden eggs. That was 87. And Austin's had this seemingly, you know, untethered growth ever since then. You'd think that they'd want to hang on to some of the charm that makes it such an awesome city.
Yeah. I mean, I just think it's a lack of planning and thought. I mean, the sort of skeptic in me will say that, you know, maybe it's down to politicians who are just interested in the election cycle and being elected next time, and not sort of thinking what are these policies going to do for 20 years time. And I'm going to talk sort of broadly about that without sort of, you know, I don't need to be specific, but what we're talking about is, you know, giving zoning, changing zoning and giving tax breaks to, you know, builders to come in and developers to build these kind of skyscrapers, these, you know, whether it be condos or whatever. If you take condos, you know, I feel like there's been a lip service being paid. They're paying lip service to this idea of affordability. So you might get a condo built in the mid 2000s and they say, okay, but a certain percentage of it, very small percentage, needs to be affordable. And we're going to use the HUD definition for affordability and we're going to make these. But what happened was you got condos being built with a certain percentage being affordable, but there was no mandatory, there was no insistence that the affordability be sort of forever. It was affordable when they were first sold, and then they could sell them, and suddenly this entire condo block was just a big profit, full profit thing.
So you get a lot of investors,
And going back to what, you know, this idea of Austin as this sort of magical place, and going back to the Keep Austin Weird thing, and you know, musicians and all the rest of it, you know, we're talking about the cultural capital of a city, right? We're talking about the people who, I believe it's the people who make a city what it is. And you know, Austin has, you know, we can talk about this kind of racial history separately, but, you know, certainly when I moved there, you've got this city that's being sold as a live music capital, which was always a marketing gimmick. But, but you know, that they were putting their money where their mouth was. There's a lot of venues and stuff. And, you know, you could walk around downtown at the weekend and just see tons and tons and tons of bands. And South by Southwest was when I started going, was a festival for musicians who were looking for something in the industry. They were either looking to get signed, or they were looking for management, or they were looking for, you know, whatever it may be. So they would play, and it was a corporate festival to begin with. It was for the music industry. They called it the spring break for the music industry.
Mm-hmm.
I went as a journalist, first of all, and covered it. And there was no, you know, you had cheap wristbands for locals to buy so they could enjoy it. But it really wasn't a place where, certainly in the UK, nobody other than the music industry had heard of South by Southwest in 2001, which was the first year I went. And back then, and I would argue up until the mid 2000s, musicians could live affordably in Austin and play gigs for not very much money and rent a room somewhere and, have a fairly, fairly good, not a good, wouldn't say a good living, but they could afford to live there. And then something happened. So the affordability thing became so profound that I think that, and I write in the book that musicians, I don't think, could afford to park downtown, let alone live there.
Alex, it wasn't the city sort of a victim of its own success here, don't you think? I mean, I can remember years ago, before we, I think before we even called them memes, people would post these pictures of the Austin city limit sign with a sticker over it that said closed, like they wanted people to stay away. So people were already talking about this many years ago, but yet those same people were telling everybody they know just how magical and amazing Austin is. And you go into this in the book and talk about how you contributed to the city's growth.
Yeah, definitely. There's a mea culpa in the book. I mean, I was there. I was desperate to move to Austin after finding the city for myself in 1999. I was desperate to find a way back. I was working for a newspaper in London and persuaded an editor to let me go and cover the music at the music festival. I think I did a travel piece first of all. So I mean, I would argue I haven't looked, but I'm pretty sure no one else had written a travel piece about Austin, Texas. Certainly not for this newspaper, but I don't think, just wasn't really on anyone's kind of radar. I hadn't really heard of it. I hadn't even heard of Austin in 1999. And I wanted to tell people about it. I was absolutely beside myself when I found out British Airways were going to start flying there, direct flights to Austin, back in the 2000s. And I told everybody who would listen, anyone who would listen. I wrote several pieces, I mean, not just one, about how great Austin was. I told everybody back home when I got married in Austin, overlooking Lake Travis, we had 30 Brits fly out. I had like 10 groomsmen, and then they just got there and thought, this place is just fantastic. But of course, that's what everybody thinks when they've just been to South by Southwest, and they still do right now. I mean, I've got friends actually from upstate New York that told me, I saw her yesterday, and she said, "Oh, we've just come back from Austin. We were there for ACL Fest. I want to move there. I hate the weather here." And I said, "Oh, that's Austin weather in October. Yeah, it's kind of a bit nicer, isn't it?"
Right, go in August and see what that's like.
Or July.
Yeah, or July or June,
Or
for that
May.
matter. You were talking about how, a lot of people have moved there over the years, and it's just become, this unchecked growth, and that the civic leaders there haven't really, put the brakes on that. In the book, though, you also get into the whole aspect of this being the seat of state government and the changes that we've seen in the tone and tenor of state government over the years. And it was, in fact, it sounded like state government was one of the big things that inspired you to leave Austin.
Yeah, I mean, so for us, and I'll be very clear that I think that we were, definitely coming from a position of privilege. I mean, we owned our own home. We bought our house in 2010, so we had a house to sell. It was easy to move. I mean, if we wanted to move back to the UK, we could. Well, my family all has two passports, so incredibly privileged. And I think the reasons we moved were, climate for one. It was just getting ridiculous. Like the heat was, I was just over it. I was over the heat. But the big factor for us, and to take your point about state government and kind of laws and stuff, was the guns thing. So I've written, I'm a journalist, and I've been a journalist for a long time, and I've written a lot about gun violence over the years. I'm a magazine writer first and foremost, so I've written big deep dive pieces about school shootings, mass shootings, gun ownership, all sorts of things. I got my gun license when you needed a gun license in Texas to own a handgun. Now you don't. And kind of this is kind of my point. And it always felt a little bit detached. I was writing these stories for a main largely British audience, although I've written for the American press as well. And it never really felt like something that impacted us in any way, until our daughter was born. Our daughter was born in 2012, and she was in daycare from sort of 6 months, and then we would start getting emails about, we've just had a successful lockdown drill, and you're thinking, this is a 6-month old having a lot. It's alien to me. You guys are from Texas, right? I mean, even in New York State, my daughter goes through lockdown drills. So this isn't alien to anyone in the United States. But for a Brit moving there with a kid in school, it's alien. We don't do that in England because we don't have the levels of gun violence that you do here. I say you do. I'm an American citizen. We do. So that became, worrying. And then I remember there was one time she was still in daycare. It was at the back of a church in Austin. It was like the back of a church, sort of church kind of hall, if you like, that where they did this daycare. And we got an email in the middle of the day saying that they were having a lockdown for real. There was an incident over the road. They didn't say what was happening. So we drove straight to the school. Of course, we couldn't go in until lockdown was over. We found out that it was a domestic incident over the road involving a handgun. And this was, obviously starting having conversations with my wife. Meanwhile, I'm writing about Parkland and I'm writing about all these school shootings that are happening. And we're having very serious conversations about keeping our daughter safe. And then, I write in the book the kind of line in the sand for us. We had already decided pretty much by 2019 that we were going to move. We hadn't sort of pulled the trigger, but if you excuse the awful pun. In August of 2019, we were back in England, and I read we read a news story out of Austin that there was this kid who was in his 20s, and a student journalist had seen him pull a bunch of guns from the trunk of his car next to Pease Park in Austin downtown. Now, Pease Park, just to give you a bit of geography, is a historic park in downtown Austin. And a few blocks away is Pease School. It's named after Elijah Pease, who's an old Texas governor, Pease. And my daughter was a student at Pease School. And so the park was where all the kids would go to play in the splash pad for birthday
Jeez.
parties. We walked our dog there. So anyway, back to the story. This student journalist says there's a kid pulling these guns out the back of his trunk. There's an AR-15, there's a handgun. And she said, I know this is you're allowed guns in this state, so maybe this is nothing, but I just thought I'd phone you. The very fact that there was even pause, should I call the police on this, is incredible. But this is Texas. And so the police turn up and they catch this guy walking towards the splash pad full of kids. And they detain him and they end up charging him initially with a misdemeanor and then finding out that there was a warrant out. I think he had a felony conviction or some conviction, and so they ended up giving charging him with a felony conviction. Anyway, he only served something like 5 months in jail, and then he was released because he didn't actually do very much at all. And I can't sit here and speculate legally what he was going to do. Who knows? But as far as I'm concerned, sitting in England watching this unfold with a kid in school, is like, I'm done. I'm done with this. And so people listening may think, well, hell, you can get guns anywhere in the US, and they're gonna tell me that there was a mass shooting in Buffalo, which there was a few years back, and they're gonna tell me that, nowhere's immune. But the truth is that New York currently is, I think, the third safest state for gun violence in the nation. And you can't stop this stuff happening when you've got 350 million guns in circulation, but you can choose to move to a state where the government tries to do things to make this situation better. And in Texas, they're not.
Alex, let's stick with politics for a moment here, because as the city was evolving, as real estate was starting to increase in value, you also talk in the book about, it wasn't all music fanatics and eccentrics who were moving there and artists who were there. There was, sinister people moving in. And you talked about how Alex Jones from InfoWars got his start on public TV there in Austin. Then you talked about Joseph Stack, a story that I covered when he flew his small private plane into the IRS building, a private, I think, five-story building, a private commercial space up on the north side of the city off Research Boulevard. And then the pro-gun supporters, which you just, discussed there. I'm curious how you think that, along with what you discussed, how has that impacted Austin's image as well?
Alex Jones is from Austin, so he was always there, but he was a sideshow. He was a sideshow. People thought it was funny. I mean, people that didn't really follow him and adhere to his kind of crazy conspiracy theories just thought he was a joke. It was Alex Jones, InfoWars. Oh my God, that guy's completely batshit crazy. I would, sorry, I don't know if I'm allowed to swear on this podcast, but we would,
Wheeler does all the time. It's okay. Go ahead.
that's all the time.
Carry on.
I'd be cycling on the cycle path in downtown Austin and see these InfoWars stickers everywhere. And it was like, his real fans were like, yeah, you need to, we would be, watching bands at emos and there were InfoWars stickers in there. It was just a thing. It was just a funny thing. And then, of course, he started saying, we knew he said 9/11 was an inside job and that was offensive, but it was like just batshit crazy. And then, of course, he then sort of started saying Sandy Hook was a didn't really happen. And this stuff just started getting more amplification, more kind of newsprint, more headlines. And I think that. I think when Elon Musk and Joe Rogan moved to town, which was pretty much as we were moving out around about the same time, it kind of occurred to me that Austin, and I really, I'll be honest with you, I really didn't really give a, really think about this stuff until I was writing the book. And like, what attracts people to Austin or to Texas like this? And I think it's this notion of freedom. I think that. Even Joe Rogan said it, like when he moved here, he said, I want a little bit more freedom. What does he mean by that? Is he really literally just talking about the fact that there's no state income tax? I don't think so. Because of course, maybe he did think that, but when you get there, you hit with the property taxes. So it really doesn't make any difference anyway. But
Right. That's
but
no walk in the park either.
yeah. But I do think that there's this thought that like the Texas those in charge, the Texas legislature, the governor and the politicians who really do push this idea of Texas equals freedom. You can say what the hell you want. You're free to say what the hell you want because we value free speech and freedom to do whatever you want above all else. So I think that that's very attractive to people who want to build a following as a sort of controversialist, maybe, and sort
Yeah,
of.
but a lot of protesters at the University of Texas and other places around Texas over this last year would disagree that it was more free. A lot of them complained that they felt like they couldn't make their voices heard right there including in Austin, which used to be this liberal enclave, this sort of carve out. And you heard people, basically voicing what you have said, that they felt like things had changed even at a local level in regard to that.
When you say they couldn't, they weren't free to say what they wanted, what specifically are
Well,
you?
that's what they were saying. This was when they were doing the protests in favor of Palestinians what was going on in Gaza, and they just felt like that was being shut down in a way that was too forceful, and that the state was involved in that as they were trying to do that on the UT campus.
Yeah, I mean, the cynic in me would say you're free to say whatever you want as long as it's along the lines of what the Greg Abbott and his cronies think is appropriate to say. As soon as you start sort of, saying we want the freedom to teach, or we want like I don't know, there's a lot of things that I think that that are considered freedom for free speech on one side and not on the other maybe. But I think yeah, look, I mean there was I mean I'm thinking back to the campus carry thing back at UT as well and the protests against that. But I mean it happened anyway. And so it's weird, this concept of freedom, if we go back to the guns thing for a second, it's like is it's freedom. So looking at campus carry, it's freedom to be able to carry a gun if I'm a law-abiding citizen, have no felony convictions and I'm 21. It's my freedom to carry a firearm around campus with me if I want to defend myself. But on the other side, there's a freedom to not feel that a student who's 21 years of age, who's arguably brain hasn't developed fully. Or certainly, I can tell you, even if that's not the case, when I was a student, there's no way I should have had a gun on campus. You know, I don't know about you, but when I was a student, it was, you know, we were drinking far too much. I mean, that's what being a student's about. So, you know, I guess the concept of freedom is an interesting one, right? Do I want the freedom as a dad for my daughter to go to a college where I know that guns are banned on campus because I want her to be safe? So there's freedom to be safe. Or is the freedom about being able to carry a gun around on campus? It's just a kind of, you know, in my view, it's a sort of twisted logic, but I sort of understand the argument.
I want to say a few things that I learned in this book that I didn't know. Wheeler, of course, knew all this stuff because he reads the journals and the annals of
Yeah,
Austin.
what didn't you know?
But I'm going to go through them. Stand by, Wheeler, stand by. And then I have one more question for you. I didn't realize, as Jason mentioned early on, that Janis Joplin got her start there back in the 60s at Threadgill's. Threadgill's, of course, isn't there anymore. I didn't know that she got her start there. I didn't realize you mentioned earlier too in this podcast, but reading your book, didn't realize that Austin is the only major U.S. city with a declining black population. It went from 8% to 7% over the last, I think, decade or so. Of course, affordability is an issue there. And I didn't know this. I should have looked it up at some point, but living in Texas for a couple of decades, I haven't done it. Austin officially became a weird city, you wrote, the year after I visited in 2000. A librarian named Red Wasenich, is that right? Or
Yeah, Wasenich, I
Wasenich?
think, yeah.
He called into a local radio station to donate to its funding drive live on air. And when asked, Red said that he was giving money to help keep Austin weird. And that, it's the moniker that the city has adopted. And, whether it survives, who knows? But my last question is, what do you think Austin's future is now, considering the cycles it's been through, considering where it is today?
I'm going to try and end on a positive note because I mean, you know, in the book, I do say that there's, you know, probably not a huge amount of chance of us moving back. And I think Austin has changed sort of, you know, from what we kind of wanted in a city. But I think that if there's the will for if you want to live in a diverse city that and diver, you know, for a diverse city with sort of, you know, artists and musicians and, you know, people that make the city tick, like line cooks and cleaners and drivers and all the rest of it, you know, Uber drivers, etc. It needs to be affordable. And, you know, I'm from London. I'm not saying London's affordable, but what London does have is a fantastic public transport system, which works. You know, I mean, this thing is built on, like, there's still tunnels that they use that were built in Victorian times for the tube network. And, you know, it's just expanding. They're putting money in. There's just a new line just opened called the Elizabeth Line, which was this latest big project. So you can get from where my friend lives in Chiswick to Liverpool Street in the east in 15 minutes, which is insane. It used to take about an hour. So they're still investing in public transport. When I lived in Austin, and still to this day, their metro system goes from downtown near the convention center to MLK. It doesn't go to the university. It doesn't really go to the east side properly. It goes up to Cedar Park. So you've got the commuter belt, which is great. You know, you've got commuters kind of living out there, but now that's unaffordable as well. So you just keep pushing people out. I've got a whole
And it
chapter,
doesn't go south of the river
and it
even
doesn't go
either. All
south,
right.
no. So, you know, I've got a chapter in my book where I interview a woman who's undocumented immigrant who had, you know, calls herself, is an Austinite more than I am because I left. But she cleans, you know, she cleans for a living, and people are more than happy to pay her minimum wage, no more, to clean. But she's sort of sitting in traffic for an hour to get into downtown now to do that. And you know, there's just not public transport. So if you want a city that really works, that you can be really proud of, that's diverse, that's affordable, you need really good public transport system, and you need a proper affordable housing policy, not one that just pays lip service to this idea so you can say we've got affordable housing.
Alex, I've got one more for you as well. So, For a lot of folks, still heading down to Austin is a treat. I mean, you've got so many gems there. You've got the state capitol. You've got Barton Springs, which is just an incredible watering hole there, Deep Eddy, et cetera. Some great restaurants, great people. You've got this very diverse, political spectrum with every viewpoint represented there in Austin for sure. There would be a lot of people, as you mentioned earlier, who would say, "Hey, this place is great. What's this guy talking about?" Maybe they didn't see it 20 years ago, or maybe they have different tastes. What has feedback been like for you? I know the book is just out, but what has the feedback been like from the folks you've been hearing from?
That's a really good question. I think my wife told me to stop looking at the comments online.
Always
And
don't look at the
that's it.
comments online.
Honestly, it's not because I'm afraid of negative comments. Honestly, I really am not. I'm a big boy. I'm very happy to sort of fight my corner and argue with someone about it. But what was noticeable about the comments online was that none of these people had actually read the book. They were basing this on headlines. The Daily Mail just did a story on the book at the weekend. The Hill have done a story. There've been all these, I've done some Q&As and stuff, and they're basing it on headlines that they've read or stories that they've read about the book or a Q&A with me. But really, I think, the book does try to sort of take a balance, and I make the point that I love Austin. I'm not against growth. I'm from London. I love London. London's a big, bustling, busy city. Someone accused me of being scared of big, bad cities. I was like, I'm a Londoner. I'm not scared of big, bad cities at all. And I'm not anti-growth. I just think it needs to, you need to kind of take into account the people that live there. And I will say, you mentioned Barton Springs. There's something somewhere in my book I talk about this artesian spring, this like natural spring called Jacob's Well in the Hill
Oh, yeah.
Country, very popular swimming hole, and it dried up a couple of years back for the fourth time in recorded history. So things are happening. There is a finite amount of water. The way that I learned this when I was writing the book, having lived in Austin for 17 years, that the aquifer, the Edwards aquifer,
Sure.
that gives people their drinking water is sort of si works symbiotically with the lakes and the rivers and stuff. It's all kind of one water source. Sorry, my earphones just come out. And it's not a finite
No.
resource. And people will argue that we've just, you'll have Texas politicians, I'm sure, saying, "We've just had this like monumental rainstorm. It hasn't stopped raining. It's been like biblical, a biblical rainstorm. What the hell are you talking about? It's not, but what I learned when I was doing the research for the book from a climate scientist is that lots of rain all at once is not what we need. It does no good for anything, because what you do is if you've had drought for a long, long period of time and everything's kind of baked, the earth is baked, that water literally just runs off. It doesn't soak into the soil and into the water table. It just sort of just disappears down the river and out into the Gulf. So it doesn't really do anything to replenish the water as much as a soaking rain over time would do. And we're going from, because of climate change, these soaking rain events to these kind of biblical rain events. And it's just not going to be. So everyone's moving to Austin, and it's the greatest place on earth when you move there. But no one's really thinking about water and climate and afford. They're thinking about affordability, but the truth is that the people that are moving there are people who can afford the astronomical rents and property prices. But we're in a slight slump, and prices are going down apparently. So there's that.
The book is titled Lost in Austin. The author is Alex Hannaford. It's a fascinating book. Sometimes I don't get enough time to read the books of guests we have on, but this one had me glued every night. So I appreciate you pulling the curtain back on what's happening down there. Congratulations on the book. Tell people where they can find it.
Thanks very much. I mean, I would say go to your local bookshop, Lost in Austin, The Evolution of American City, but it's also available online as well.
It is a very engaging reading. And Alex, just something for you to put on Twitter or Facebook or wherever you're, maybe getting some online trolling. Jason Whiteley actually read through most of this book. I can't remember a time he has done that. He said he just couldn't put it on. Honestly, he couldn't stop reading it. Like,
Oh, that's so
and I've
kind.
never heard him say that ever.
It is
Thank you.
captivating because it pulls the curtain back on Austin, and that's why I think it's fantastic. And Wheeler reads all kinds of things. We won't get into that though.
Yeah,
Alex, great stuff,
another
man.
podcast.
Congratulations. Yeah, I got another
Thank you so
podcast
much.
indeed.
Thanks, guys.
Another
I really
season.
appreciate it.
Thanks, Alex. We'll see you, man.
Alex, thank
Thank
you.
you.
Want to see the Jasons talk politics? Download the WFAA Plus streaming app for your smart TV and watch the latest episode of Y'allitics.